I want to talk a little bit about my college days. It's hard to believe that this academic year marks 10 years since I've been a senior in college. So mismatched is good for my feelings right now. It took me a while to get good at school in college, and I don't remember, I think it was my sophomore year until I remember one sentence or phrase that any of my professors had said. So while I was a sophomore at the 2014 Men's and Women's NCAA Champion UConn Huskies at the University of Connecticut, just wanted to get that in, I was an English major, and my professor was teaching on epistemology, how we know what we know, the process of learning, and she used a phrase, it was more the illustration that she used that finally caught my attention, and it was called cognitive dissonance. And I didn't know what that meant, but I remember the illustration she used. She said, cognitive dissonance, especially in the literature realms, occurs when you're reading something and it so offends you or disturbs you or kind of tears your worldview apart that you take the book and you fling it across the room. I was like, oh, okay, I'm cognitively dissonant about school. That works. I like that. But I sort of kept that with me throughout these last 10 years. In fact, I remember a friend I was in class with, she was in the same class as me, and later in that semester, she was telling me about how she was reading her Bible, and she was reading like a newer translation that did not appeal to her Christian sensibilities, and she disagreed with how a verse was rendered, and she threw the Bible across the room, and she was very happy to report in class that she had a cognitively dissonant experience. And okay, Bible throwing, but hey, it evoked emotion. That's what it was all about. Later on, I had my own experience of cognitive dissonance. It wasn't with a book. I was playing Xbox, and I was playing an NBA 2K game, and I had a really high rank, like online in the standings, which meant I was just rolling through all those middle schoolers, like just trash talking, microphone like this, just plowing through them, top of the leaderboards. And then there was one probably 11-year-old that he just had my number. And the worst thing you can do in that game is when you make a great play, you can actually push pause and replay it over and over and over so your opponent has to see. So this guy was replaying like the game-winning shot over and over and over and over. And I got so mad and I was so cognitively dissonant, so mismatched. I'm like, "What? Who I am, my identity, my scoreboard, my ranking is not matching my experience." So I got emotionally frustrated and I flung the Xbox controller across the room into a bright green, big, cushy chair that we have. Except in my competitive state, I must have had my old school competitive wiffle ball grip on the controller. It had to be a slider grip because I was aiming for the chair, but I hooked it. You gotta break the wrist when you throw a slider, and this thing went that way right through our window. So the window smashed. I immediately said out loud, "I have a problem." And I said, "Oh, Jen is going to come home to this." And then she came home, and I was sort of standing there with the puppy dog look. I got angry. And she said, "It's okay." And she came over, and she gave me a hug, and we cleaned up the glass. Yeah, when I said later on, I meant like a year ago in our apartment. And she was great and gracious, and we got through it. And I don't own an Xbox anymore. So cognitive dissonance, let's go from a funny story to a boring definition. If you see the bottom of the screen, Wikipedia actually nailed this. I went through a bunch of definitions. They did the best. So here's a definition. Cognitive dissonance: the mental stress or discomfort experienced by an individual who holds two or more contrary beliefs, ideas, or values at the same time. That one's okay. I like this one. Or is confronted by new information that conflicts with existing beliefs, ideas, or values. Like the new information that a middle schooler is better at video games than me conflicted and I reacted. It goes on. Humans strive for internal consistency. When consistency or dissonance is experienced, individuals tend to become psychologically uncomfortable and are motivated to attempt to reduce the dissonance, as well as actively avoiding situations and information which are likely to increase it. So I don't play middle schoolers online and video games anymore. The most historic framework here comes from Aesop's Fables, The Fox and the Grapes. There's a tree, and there's a big stack of grapes hanging down, and the fox wants to get to it, but he's not a good climber, he can't jump high enough, and he's, how do I get these grapes, how do I get these grapes? He eventually rationalizes and says, I don't even want the grapes, they're not worth it, they probably don't even taste good. That's reducing dissonance. Same as book throwing, get that thing far away from me, same as video game controller throwing. And this is all over scriptures, and this matters in the life of faith. So we're going to look at dissonance in the scriptures, and we're going to kind of sit in the tension of it, and then this morning God is going to evoke a response from us. What do we want to do with this dissonance? So you could look up here with me, or you could turn in your pew Bible. It's page 555, and we're going to talk about the experience of the writer. Verse 1, he says, I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, the muddy muck that Lily was just talking to the kids about. Out of the mud and the mire, he set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. There's a lot of action going on right away. There's waiting. There's God's turning. In the original languages, it's like God condescending, bending over, giving his ear. Oh, you have something to say? Let me come and listen to you. And he makes himself available. It's a really sweet phrase. He lifted me up. He set my feet down. He gave me a place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth. It's a great story. I looked up a lot of resources, and a lot of people just like to teach on this one phrase, this one passage in the psalm. It's a great story. It evokes happy feelings. Stuff was rough. God took care of it. Now I'm happy. That's great. But that's the beginning. That's the assumption. Why do I call this the assumption? Why is it assumed? It's following a script. These phrases of God rescuing and putting feet on a secure ground and coming down to hear and listen, it's how the Israelites understood the best of who God was to them as a deliverer. These psalms, they were used in worship, and they would sing them. And when they would sing them, they would, in their memory, they would go back to the Exodus story when God rescued the Israelites out of Egypt. So Exodus 2, we don't have to turn there. It just says, during the long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out. And their cry for help, because of their slavery, went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. So the psalmist's, his experience is mirroring kind of the collective memory of the Israelites and who they were. The psalmist cried out. God hears the cry of the Israelites. God looked upon the psalmist. God looks upon the Israelites. He turned to the psalmist. There was a hearing. There was a responding. It's great. The psalmist is writing. He's like, I'm following the script. This is how it's supposed to go. I'm an Israelite. I'm in trouble. I'm supposed to do this. God is supposed to do that. It happened. This is great. Hence, there's a new song in my mouth. And even this is part of the script. At the end of the Exodus story here, Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. I will sing to the Lord, for he's highly exalted. Both horse and driver he has hurled into the sea. It's a catchy tune. 20 verses later, Miriam sings the same song. Sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. both horse and driver. He has hurled into the sea. He took care of the enemies. The psalmist's experience is matching the historic experience of Israelites. Things are lining up. The Exodus story is arguably the most important story to ancient Hebrews and Jewish believers today. So this guy, he was happy. God must love me because my story is matching up to the historical experience. And then he wants to share it. Many will see and fear the Lord and put their trust in him. Blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, who does not look to the proud, to those who turn aside to false gods. This recalls Psalm 1, which we heard Jaime speak on. Happy is the person who God delivers. And after God delivers, he chooses into God over and over and over. Verse 5, many, Lord my God, are the wonders you have done, the things you planned for us. None can compare with you. Were I to speak and tell of your deeds, they would be too many to declare. Other translations say something like, I'm going to go tell everybody about your deeds, but there's so many, I can't do it. It's clear the writer owned this experience. Whatever the problem was, whatever the mud and the muck and the mire and the pit and the circumstance was, God took care of him. We don't know exactly how, but this guy owns it and celebrates it, and he wants to share it and pass it on with everybody else. Then he goes into a little teaching about who God is and the character of God, and it's really beautiful. Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but my ears you have opened. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. Then I said, here I am. I have come. It is written about me in the scroll. I desire to do your will, my God. Your law is within my heart. I proclaim your saving acts in the great assembly. I do not seal my lips, Lord, as you know. I do not hide your righteousness in my heart. I speak of your faithfulness and your saving help. I do not conceal your love and your faithfulness from the great assembly. There's this cool phrase in verse 6, my ears you have opened. Literally, it's you have dug out my ears. I have another story recently. I had to go to the doctor because, just kidding, that's a story. That's a real story, but for another time. You have dug out my ears. You didn't want me to bring anything to you. You just wanted me to be in a posture of listening. Listening is the best place to be in this story. And then after listening, he said, here I am, I have come. It is written about me in the scroll. It's a little strange. What scroll? This might be the author having documented, journaled, if you will, his experience. And now he's in the great temple among his Israelite brothers and sisters. And he says, hey, I wrote it down. This is on the record. God really did this for me. That might be the case. It might be also he's saying, it's in the scroll. This is the Exodus story. I'm connecting my story with that story. Either way, the writer is again, this happened. I'm connected to my ancient faith, and I'm going forward because this is awesome. I love what God did in my life. Now, this might be a little bit too perfect of an experience right now. It's still a really good story at this point. But you have to credit the writer for doing this one thing, for really, really owning it, and for wanting to pass it on, and for wanting to get up in front of all his brothers and sisters and say, this is what God did for me. He did it in the past. He's still doing it today. That's something we believe here in this church, by the way. He owns it. He internalizes it. He celebrates it. He shares it. Best of all, he lets this experience rightly shape who he sees God as. He's a deliverer. He's a rescuer. He was with me in the pit, and now he's going forward with me. And that's all well and good until we get to the conflict. Good story, but now it doesn't match up. In verse 11, do not withhold your mercy from me, Lord. May your love and faithfulness always protect me. for troubles without number surround me. My sins have overtaken me, and I cannot see. They are more than the hairs of my head, and my heart fails within me. Be pleased to save me, Lord. Come quickly, Lord, to help me. This is what the psalmist had in mind the whole time. It's a psalm of petition. He wasn't taking a stroll through memory lane just for the heck of it and remembering all the good times and the nostalgia. In a liturgical setting, in a worship service, people would pray this way. They'd say, God, remember the good times and everything you did for me. And it was a way of reminding God, hey, buddy, you did it for me once. Where the heck are you? Why isn't this matching up? I'm still in the play. I'm still tracking with the script. Why are you rambling off screen now? What's going on? This is the point the psalmist wanted to get to. What's going on? Did you stop listening? You did it once. Why won't you do it again? Can you do something about that, please? Speaking of my college years, I remember my first experience with dissonance in faith. I came to start following Jesus at 19 years old between my freshman and sophomore years of college. And I had what my friend would describe as a pretty easy sort of conversion experience. I grew up semi-religious, but I didn't have anything personal to do with God. I didn't know he knew my name. I didn't know he was after my heart. I didn't know he wanted to love me and love me and love me, and I didn't know any of that stuff. So he takes me to church for a few times. I hear an offer. If you want in, you're already in. Just get in. Just get in. I said, okay, I want in. I want God. I think that's the best thing for my life at this point. That's the best I could have articulated at the time. So in my mind, all I had to do was hear it. Oh, I get it. Jesus loves me. He died on the cross. He resurrected. I don't know how that works, but I know he loves me. I'm in. Wow. All I needed to do was hear it. Like, this is just new information. So if the new information works for me this easily, I'm going to go back to college and give all my friends the same new information, and it'll work just the same for them as it worked for me. Oh, this is going to be great. So I go back to college. I had my 1 year of kind of partying and going a little crazy and having a lot of fun. And now I come back and I'm super religious in everybody else's eyes. And I'm like, hey, Jesus, Bible, saved, all these code words. And they're like, dude, what happened to you? You were fun last year. And I was a fun guy. I went out of my way to be a fun guy because I didn't perceive myself as a fun guy in high school. So I had 1 year of having a lot of fun, and then I go back as a sophomore, and I had signed up to live with my best friend for my freshman year, and we were going to have like the party room. But then I show up, and I'm like, I don't think I'm into that stuff anymore. And I went from being the new fun guy my freshman year to like the religious loser to avoid my sophomore year. And it hurt. I mean, I lost friends. And then it turned into this whole, like, martyr complex. I'm going to be the most exiled for Jesus, and no one's going to like me, and that means God loves me. Yeah, it just turned into this whole religious sort of mess that I needed to work through. But God stayed with me. Even when I thought he went off script, it worked for me. Why won't it work for them? I'm friends with most of those guys now. I repaired some of the damage. But it was dissonance. This happened. This doesn't match. Where do we go from here? That's the conflict. Last week, Pastor Jeff made a great point about honesty. And the Psalms are the place in the Bible where life is expressed at its most raw. And we have one of those expressions in verse 14. May all who want to take my life be put to shame and confusion. May all who desire my ruin be turned back in disgrace. May those who say to me, aha, aha, or in my case, as a college sophomore, loser, may they be appalled at their own shame. But may all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. May those who long for your saving help always say, the Lord is great. So we went from on script to off script, and everything doesn't make sense right now. And I want things fixed. May the right people be happy, and may all the detractors and the enemies be sad. Not necessarily the most healthy perspective, but it's a truly evoked feeling of hurt. And what do we do with this? The non-resolution, verse 17. I call it a non-resolution because we don't really know how the story ends. But as for me, I am poor and needy. May the Lord think of me. Just like you did to the Israelites in the Exodus. They heard our cries. Lord, think of me. Just like you did when I was stuck in the muck and the mire, and I called out, and you inclined, you bent down, you stooped down towards me. Think of me again. Hear me again. You're my God. Do not delay. What's the posture? When everything is good and great, and you're sharing, and you're celebrating, and you're owning it, and that's all good, but then you sort of forget, what happens when it gets bad again? Well, the first thing to do is really own the good stuff. Really, really own it. Build your life upon the great things that God does so that when things go off script, you remember. And you have something to remind God of. Hey, do it for me again. I will. You just need to be remind me that it's about me and you should be a little more humble. That works. But here's the hard part. The psalm was built upon this great experience of getting rescued. And some of you have been sitting here and wondering, the whole story is built on that foundation. This whole psalm, this whole message. I've never had a good experience with God. I don't know if I can talk about deliverance or rescue. I'm still in the middle of it. I'm on a faith kind of journey figuring stuff out, but I don't know if I've had this intimate sort of encounter that you're talking about. That's what we want to talk about. Step one, say so. Be honest with that. I don't think this applies to me because I've never had this experience. Good. Own it. Sit with it. Feel it. Wonder why I haven't experienced God the way all these other people talk about it. Feel it. It's the Psalms. It's ruthless honesty. And after you sit with it for a while, you look up at this verse and you say, I can't manufacture a God experience for myself. I can't make it up. I don't want to lie about it. I don't want to fit into someone's paradigm. Oh, you should have had this happen, blah, blah, blah. No. Be poor and needy. I don't want to fake this. I want the real thing. And then you go for it. Track with the inconsistency. You know what a good little catchphrase for the Psalms might be, at least a good portion of them? God is inconsistent. Might be true, might not be true, but it's how you feel. Feel it. And work with it. Today we celebrate communion, which means that, among other things, we celebrate how Jesus came to meet us in our dissonance with God. The incarnation, when he came, God came in the flesh. He came and put on the human experience. And part of the human experience is feeling out of step with God. Jesus came to put us within God's reach, maybe for the very first time. Our custom is we have prayer people set up near our stations for communion. And today I briefed our prayer people, and they're ready to pray an encounter with you. If you're looking for an experience with God, I've never had a touch, I've never heard his voice, I've never felt his presence, I've never had the embrace I feel like I should have with God. Good. Today's your day. All the prayer people that have been briefed, would you mind just standing where you are? Just so you know, there's a lot of you. Some of our elders are in the back and upstairs that are going to be joining as well. And our prayer people, thanks guys, you can sit down. They're going to be dispersed, and they're ready to pray, encounter, warmth, embrace, love. I know you've been feeling this way. I've been waiting for you to come to me with it. And we're going to do that. You don't need to feel ready. You don't need to bring sacrifices. You just got to be poor and needy. Pastor Jeff's going to come up in a moment, and he's going to lead us through communion. I want you to sit and feel the tension and ponder one last illustration from the text. Lots of scholars and commentators make the argument that the first half of this psalm and the second half of this psalm are actually two completely different psalms. That somewhere along the way, as the Bible is being formed, they got smushed together, and they shouldn't be. That may or may not be true. If they are, in fact, two different psalms, I'm going to say this. God was in charge of that smushing process. And if they are, in fact, two radically different experiences, it was God who superseded the smushing and said, I know this is how life is. It feels great, then it feels not so great. I'm in the middle of that too. So breathe with the tension of a life of faith. And ask yourself if you're ready for the encounter. Then have the courage to go after it and make your complaint out loud, just like the psalmist did. We'll give you a moment to ponder that.